You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we take a look at an unsuccessful copyright lawsuit against songwriter and performer Ed Sheeran and what it means for the future of music. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum remembering a woman whose life was cut far too short. We share the story in honor of the recent Missing or Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day.
Menominee tribal member Ray Elaine Turtelot was 18 when she went missing on the tribe's reservation during the fall of 1986. Tribal police and the FBI found her remains the following spring. Her daughter, Elise Arce, and relative Andrea Lemke Roshan sat down to talk about Ray with WPR's Daniel Kading. They also shared their hopes for a new task force that's focused on murdered and missing Indigenous women in Wisconsin.
My name is Elise Arce. I'm Ray's daughter.
I'm Andrea Lemke Roshan, and I'm Ray Elaine's cousin and friend. Ray Elaine was pure joy. She and I grew up together. We were kids. She lived on the reservation and I didn't. So I loved whenever we would go visit. She was laughing all the time. She was a huge joker and just a really beautiful girl and a really beautiful young woman. And that beauty radiated really from the inside out.
I just know that she was really outgoing and she had a lot of spirit and a lot of lift. She loved to dance, powwow dance. She was a Menominee princess. She was very into our culture, singing and drumming class, Menominee language.
The time we would spend together, she would try to teach me Menominee. She tried to teach me to dance. She told me I was a hopeless dancer. I never quite could do it, but she was a gorgeous dancer. She did fancy dancing, and that's supposed to mimic a butterfly. And Ray Elaine looked like a butterfly embodied when she danced. It was just really beautiful.
And she was very family oriented.
I hadn't seen Elise in a few years, and I had gone back up for a family gathering at my cousin Ray's sister's house. And Elise and I, Elise, you were a teenager, but we were on a pontoon boat ride together. And Elise threw her head back and laughed. And I thought, oh my God, there she is. There's Ray. There's Ray Lane right there, right in front of me.
It's nice to hear stuff like that because a part of me feels like she's living through me. She's always around me all the time.
I remember getting a message saying, you need to call home right away. It was in October of 1986. And I called home and my mom was sobbing. She just couldn't even get the words out to tell me that Ray was missing. And I couldn't wrap my head around it because I knew she had just given birth to Elise.
I was only 2 months old when this happened. This was something that kind of shook our whole reservation from what I know, because my aunties kept newspaper clippings and everything from way back then.
We learned that part of her body had been found in a beaver dam on the reservation. So it was very, very hard.
I just don't want any other family to go through what we went through. I see and I know the pain of my family because I can see it in their eyes and how they are.
I think this Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women work is the first time that I feel like there's something tangible that I can do to try to make a difference. We really do want to raise awareness that this is a problem impacting Native women and Native girls, and we need it to stop, and we want it to stop.
It's something that needs to be fixed within the system, and that's why I'm saying, like, I don't want any other family dealing with what we are dealing with. I don't want people going off with cold cases for 34 years. I don't want them to have this pain that we carry around with us every day. That's what I want out of this, because I mean, and I feel like that would be her only justice of this, is to help other families, because nobody should ever have to feel what we felt.
WPR's Daniel Kading brought us that story, remembering Ray Elaine Turtelot, a Menominee tribal member who was killed in 1986. Her family is participating in the new Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Now, what makes a song unique? Is it the voice of the person singing it, the lyrics, the bass line, the melody, the chord progression? What if one song really reminds you of another song? Has one artist copied another, or is inspiration more complicated than that? These questions are in the news after an unsuccessful lawsuit against Ed Sheeran for his song Thinking Out Loud, which heirs of songwriter Ed Townsend claimed was a copy of the 1973 classic Let's Get It On, which Townsend had co-written with Marvin Gaye. We're talking about copyright infringement and creative freedom when it comes to music. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are there songs that you think are just plain ripoffs of other songs? Do you have questions about how the law applies to musical creativity? Have you been following this particular case against Ed Sheeran? What do you think of the songs and the verdict? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jim Jesse is an attorney and musician who specializes in music law. He's also the founder of Rock and Roll Law, an organization providing continuing education for lawyers on music copyright law. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, hang on while we get a taste of each of the songs in this particular case. We'll start with the 1973 Marvin Gaye classic, Let's Get It On. Okay, that's the older song in this lawsuit, and now here's Ed Sheeran with Thinking Out Loud.
Darling, I will be loving you till we're 70.
Okay, Jim, chord progression on the verse there, spot on. I think they're a half step apart, I read. Melody, very different. So how does a case like this end up in court?
Well, Ed Townsend, apparently, or his estate, he actually passed away in 2003, you know, sued Ed Sheeran. Sheeran did not settle, so it I guess, had enough merit to go to trial. I agree with you. There's a general, sort of the feel is similar, the vibe, maybe the same chords, yeah, as you said. Chords are not copyrightable, though, because then no one would be able to write songs. So... you know, and if the melody's not similar, that's a lot of the song. I mean, obviously, you mentioned a lot of the other elements that are in songs. You know, and obviously, there's expert testimony on both sides. And a jury found that the plaintiff did not meet their burden of proof.
Now, with cases like this, copyright cases, a songwriter or a songwriter's estate sues another songwriter. Do we have a really good, solid foundation of law, or is it, hey, if you can convince this jury in this case, you win, and maybe a different jury would have read it differently, and it's just kind of up in the air?
Yes, juries do strange things sometimes, so obviously they're the ultimate deciders of the facts and the law. I mean, it's all court-made law, a lot of these cases. This one was in New York or California here, a lot of these cases. I mean, there's two main things a plaintiff has to prove. One is access. Okay, you can't copy something unless you've heard it. I don't think Sheeran denied it wouldn't be very believable if he said, I never heard Let's Get It On. Apparently, he had sung both at a concert. That was the plaintiff's, I guess, smoking gun evidence. And then you have to prove similarity, substantial similarity, not just kind of similar. And then there's expert testimony on both sides. And then a jury basically has to decide, is the only reason, you know, these similarities is from copying rather than, you know, you just happen to create it independently and it sounds alike, which is possible.
I want to go back to 1976 and a successful case, songwriter John Mack against George Harrison. Now, here's John Mack's song performed by the Chiffons, He's So Fine. Okay, and then here's George Harrison, My Sweet Lord.
My sweet Lord.
Okay, so this was a successful lawsuit, Jim, and the focus was on the melody here. And it seems like, yeah, if anything is going to get you in trouble, apart from just ripping off somebody's lyrics, I guess, it's going to be if your melody is spot on, as it was in this case, that other song. Is that a good smoking gun in a lawsuit like this?
Yeah, I mean, and obviously if the lyrics are the same, that's going to be
that's
pretty
a cover.
You don't need to go to trial for that. Yes, and in this case, this is an interesting case for a lot of reasons. Harrison, this is his first post-Beatles solo debut. It's a triple album, All Things Must Pass. Comes out late 1970. The reviewer in Rolling Stone magazine actually says, boy, this sounds a lot like, My Sweet Lord sounds a lot like He's So Fine. The publisher sues Harrison, the publisher of He's So Fine. The case doesn't go to trial until 76, so obviously Harrison didn't deny. I mean, he'd heard the Chiffon song, He's So Fine, came out in the early 60s. So similarity, again, I suspect there's similar chords, and subconsciously, all songwriters love music, and they listen to lots of music, and some of it may seep in. If you use similar chords are groups of notes played together, usually on a piano or guitar. The likelihood of you singing the same melody, you can only sing certain notes within those chords, is therefore increased. And it went to trial. The judge, by the way, had composed an opera, so he knew something of music law or music, apparently. And he found that, quote, it was the same song with different lyrics. Ouch, poor George.
And I was reading back to the coverage at the time. The judge, I believe, said, I don't think you did this on purpose. I don't think this was a deliberate theft, but it was so close that the effect was the same as if he'd stolen it.
Exactly. And I don't think any songwriter deliberately does it. Again, you might be inspired to write something. You might, like I said, similar chords, maybe subconsciously he heard it. Songs come about, and I also write songs, mysteriously. They just kind of, it's a stroke of lightning sometimes. And so, and there's a lot of songs out there. And so the likelihood of them sounding alike is there, or at least somewhat alike, is therefore greater, particularly, like I said, when you're using, there's, in the rock and pop realm, there's certain chords that sound good together, and lots of songs use the same chords.
We're talking to music law expert Jim Jesse about music copyright law after a high-profile lawsuit against songwriter and performer Ed Sheeran was rejected. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think counts as plagiarism when it comes to music in particular? What's the difference between being inspired by something and kind of ripping it off? Are you a songwriter yourself? Have you ever accidentally rewritten somebody else's song? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with music law expert Jim Jesse about music, copyrights, and when a song is too close for comfort to another song. This comes after a rejected lawsuit against songwriter and performer Ed Sheeran. You can join in if you have questions about how this works. If there's a song you think is suable, it's too similar to another song you've encountered. Musicians out there, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jim, I want to talk about what's at stake in suits like this. We had Ed Sheeran saying, he's a popular songwriter and performer, and he was saying, I would get out of songwriting, maybe out of music, if this case is successful, for fear of future lawsuits. We heard other people kind of along those lines. If there are a lot of rulings on these borderline cases against songwriters, is there a concern that, all right, people aren't going to write more songs?
I think that's overstated. I mean, I don't think anyone has not written a song because they're afraid of getting sued. You write songs because you're inspired to do so. I don't think that's the reality. Obviously, Ed Sheeran's high profile. Look, if the Townsend estate had won, potentially they step into the shoes of Ed Sheeran and make all the money he made off of his song, and possibly even some of the album sales as well, because people may buy an album or CD based upon that particular song. So I understand the risk there. But, you know, and these are high profile cases that make the news. But, you know, it's not that common that these cases occur.
Now, I'm a musician. I don't write songs precisely because every time I come up with a brilliant song idea, I pretty soon realize, oh, it's exactly an awesome song that somebody else already wrote. How much, if I were to take the chance and start putting out songs like that, how much due diligence do I have to do? What do I have to do to cover myself when inevitably somebody realizes, Rob, you just wrote this other song?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you just, I guess, run it by other people. Obviously, you may think it's original. I guess just knowing yourself, I mean, look, the odds, it's going to, you know, all music is derivative if you drill down to a granular enough level, you know. And frankly, I have enough trouble getting people to listen to my music, let alone suing me for copyright infringement. So I don't think it's, like I said, the cases tend to be high-profile people as defendants, maybe higher profile or slightly less profile. I mean, I dare say everybody's heard of the Let's Get It On, but, you know, very few people have probably heard of Ed Townsend before this lawsuit. So, and obviously the Sheeran song, was it Thinking Out Loud, you know, huge hit, billion, you know, millions of tens of millions of streams, et cetera. So I don't know. I don't think there's a foolproof way to know, to be honest.
We are talking about the finer points of musical copyright law when inspiration turns into imitation and even intellectual property theft. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jim Jesse is with us. He's an attorney and musician who specializes in music law. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Got a question from Gary in Jackson who couldn't come on the air, but he wonders, what about Weird Al? So what about parody, Jim? What kind of cover is that? Is there legally if I want to do a parody of a song?
Good question. Weird Al always gets permission. Obviously uses the same melody. He could argue it's some sort of fair use exception, but Weird Al always gets permission from the writers or owners of the song he is parodying. So that's not a straight up cover. Now, a straight up cover is if I covered Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye, and I pay a small royalty to, you know, whoever owns the song or the publisher, I can cover it, you know, as long as I don't change the melody or the lyrics appreciably. You know, I can certainly change the arrangement. We've all heard cover songs that are vastly different arrangements. So, by the way, I thought of a way, Rob, for you to write a song.
Ooh.
Play it in a Shazam app and then see if it comes up as anything. Okay, there you go.
Excellent.
There's your answer.
I'll try that next time. I want to ask about law and sampling, Jim, because the late Clyde Stubblefield, the original funky drummer, longtime resident of Wisconsin, he passed away a few years back. I talked to him in this room, and he was very unhappy with the use of his funky drummer beat in zillions of rap and other songs, and money not going to him. What is the state of the art of the law when it comes to building a song off of a sample of someone like Clyde Stubblefield?
Yeah, and that's too bad. I mean, I'll tell you what the law is. It's like speeding, though. I'm not sure everybody follows the law. Mm-hmm. But it's if you've got to clear it. I mean, and so I don't know. If you use the actual sounds in another subsequent recording, you've got to clear it with whoever owns the, what is called the sound recording or the master recording. And then you always have to clear it with the songwriter or publisher. So now I will say this too, something in order to be copyrightable has to be what is called original. Original is a low bar, but you know, playing drums on the 2 and 4 beat is not original. You know, playing the D, C, G on a guitar is not original. Could be done in original ways and that's potentially copyrightable, but you know, it has to have a minimal or modicum of creativity. So not everything's copyrightable, and that gets us back to the Sheeran case. You know, just because songs have the same general feel or vibe, that's just not enough. It's too broad. It's too vague, if that helps.
Sure.
Samples, clear your samples. No set rate. You just negotiate. By the way, that's why you see, you know, songs by Beyonce with 20 co-writers, because they're all, you know, clearing the samples, and they're putting them on as songwriters.
Let's bring on a caller. Celia is with us in Madison. Celia, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for this opportunity. I have a manuscript on women in World War II, and the normal quote for acceptable quote without getting permission from a textbook or, you know, a work, a written work, is 300 words. But I quote like 7 to 10 words from the very popular song, I'll Be Seeing You, you know, the small park across the way, the et cetera.
Gotcha. See, we don't have a lot of time. Jim, I know this is maybe a little outside your area. Can an author quote a World War II standard in brief?
Yes. I mean, there's no such, you know, there's no word cutoff, though. It's just, it goes to fair use. I mean, obviously, if you reprint the whole song, Celia, I think that would be an issue. But if you're just printing a line or two, it's probably fair use. I mean, I can't, you know, say for certain, but, you know, again, assuming the song's not in the public domain, if a song's in the public domain, then anybody can use it. There's no permissions needed.
Celia, thanks a lot for the call. And Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Jim Jesse, an attorney and musician who specializes in music law. He's the founder of Rock and Roll Law. That's an organization that provides continuing education for lawyers on music copyright law. He talked to us today about the verdict in a copyright lawsuit against songwriter Ed Sheeran over Sheeran's song Thinking Out Loud. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, TV and movie writers went on strike last week. Find out about the contract issues that led to the walk-off and what it can end up meaning for the movies and TV shows we watch. Plus, we'll look at loneliness, social connection, and the places we connect, and places where we don't have places to connect out in public. You can share your thoughts right now at ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, dig into the history and culture of different regions of the United States and how they fit into modern-day gun violence statistics. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Republican State Senator Joan Balwick joins the show for a look at the latest news from the state's Joint Finance Committee and how they're working on Wisconsin's next state budget. First, from high-profile mass shootings like the attack at a Texas mall this weekend to the daily toll of gun suicide and homicide deaths, the United States has a much higher rate of firearm fatalities than other industrialized countries. But there's a lot of variation within the United States from region to region. Our next guest dug into the regional differences in gun deaths around the U.S. He says there are deep cultural traditions around firearms that date back to the earliest days of colonial expansion and the founding of the United States. And in a recent piece, he makes the case that those traditions shape our attitudes and laws on guns to this day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived in different parts of the country or the state? What have you noticed about different attitudes toward firearms in one community or another? Does the gun culture look different from place to place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Colin Woodard is the director of the Nationhood Lab at Salve Regina University's Pell Center. He's a Politico magazine contributing editor, and his books include American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. His piece on guns in American cultural regions is linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Colin, welcome back to the show.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into differences within the United States, can you talk about how the U.S. stacks up versus comparable countries when it comes to gun deaths?
Very badly. I mean, if you compare the United States to other wealthy industrialized democracies in Europe and East Asia, Australia, New Zealand, I mean, we're decimal places different in our per capita rates for firearm homicides, especially, and suicides are both high. So we're sort of off the charts amongst our peer countries.
Before we dig again into the particular regions, I want to talk about how you divide this up. You've been on the network before talking about that book I mentioned, American Nations. Can you give us a quick overview of how you divvy things up? It's not, you know, Midwest or Great Lakes or whatever. It's more cultural in some ways than the map itself.
Absolutely. I like to think that we are presenting the actual regional map. And to understand regions, you have to go back to history, understand where did these regions come from, who settled them, who laid down the values. That's the story told in American Nations. And the resulting, you know, paradigm and model is what we work with at Nationhood Lab to examine all sorts of phenomenon in American life, from elections to COVID-19 vaccination rates to indeed gun violence, where regional geography matters. And regional geography matters a great deal in everything in American life, past and present. The way that this model works is, you know, it argues that we are separate countries. We were founded as separate countries. And by that, I mean the different colonial projects that formed on the eastern and southwestern rims of what's now the United States. The Puritans in New England, the Scots-Irish moving into the backcountry and rafting down the Ohio River to colonize some of the lower Great Lakes states, the gentlemen, second, third sons of English gentry into the Chesapeake country, the Spanish moving south to north into the southwest, the sort of English West Indies slave lords moving from Barbados and bringing their West Indies plantation slave society into the lowlands around Charleston, and by extension, all of the cotton deep south. These are all separate cultures founded at different times with different religious and ethnographic and political characteristics, ideas of the kind of society they were creating, the kind of economy they were working in. And the most important thing to understand is they each colonized mutually exclusive strips of this continent out into the 1840s before there was significant in-migration that didn't belong to one of these idiosyncratic groups. And in doing so, you know, three-fifths of our continent were colonized by these groups. And you can see, if you know the settlement history of these rival settlement streams, you can see it in all manner of phenomenon at the county level, because they didn't follow state boundaries. That's why you have red states and blue states indeed, but also why you have states that are perennially riven into different geographic sections like California and Ohio or Pennsylvania or upstate and downstate Illinois, where they've never seen eye to eye even back in the territorial period.
In this new piece now that I'm talking about, you take this concept and map it along with gun deaths. And we're talking a homicide and suicide. You do those together and separate them out. Big picture, which major regions see the highest per capita gun deaths overall?
Yeah, there's a staggering difference between the big regional cultures. And Deep South is usually on the worst end of the spectrum. The area that my home state of Maine, Rhode Island, where the Pell Center is located, and Wisconsin are, this sort of greater, I guess you could call it New England space, I call Yankeedom, where New Englanders and their descendants were the first effective settlers spread out over that particular section. The difference between those two sections, roughly the same population, 50 million-ish, the per capita difference is two and threefold different, depending on whether you're looking at homicide or suicide, and persists if you look at, say, the white victim only homicide and suicide, or cities only and beyond. And the difference between the Deep South and the safest of these regional cultures, which is the Dutch founded area around what's now New York City, the boroughs, you know, half of Long Island, the lower Hudson, northern New Jersey, you know, sort of metropolitan New York City, you might say, the Deep South is sevenfold, eightfold, even ninefold worse, depending on which factors you're looking at in terms of deadly gun violence. So it is indeed as if you're living in separate countries. In some factors, you know, that New Netherland area around New York City, you know, has rates, you know, comparable to Canada's, whereas, you know, the Deep South, the rates are comparable to places in Central America and elsewhere.
Start sketching out or connect the dots here between the different cultural foundations of those extremes in the regions and how they connect to gun death rates today.
Yeah, we were interested at Nationhood Lab in looking at gun violence because we knew there would be pretty big geographical differences, because there's been scholarship going back decades where people have looked at why is it that Both data and even centuries ago, just stories all attested to violence being of all sorts being much more intense in the South, in quotes, than in the North. And a lot of that scholarship had developed some cultural explanations. And one of them is that, I mean, the, you know, if you have a society based on slaveholding, as in the Deep South, where in many of these colonies, enslaved people were a majority of the population, actually holding them down by horrible violence or the threat thereof, and that that's built into society, and then enforced, you know, after slavery ended in the 1860s, another century of a racial caste system enforced by vigilante gangs and off, you know, duty law enforcement and the force of law, that violent heritage plays out into the society in the ways that violence is considered to be appropriate in the use of vigilante justice and the like. But also in greater Appalachia, the space that's not only Appalachian range, but the southern tiers of some of the lower Great Lakes states, and a settlement stream that extended onwards into the Ozarks and even the Texas Hill Country. It's a big, in fact, it's the most populous of all the regional cultures. That region was largely settled by Scots-Irish, who include a lot of my ancestors. And they were coming from the lowlands of Scotland and the English Marches and Ulster, Northern Ireland. They were, these were war-torn areas in the British context, you know, between Scotland and England, and later between lowland Scots brought by the English and the Irish that they were trying to conquer and take the land from. And these were places where, you know, institutional institutions were weak. You had to defend your kith and kin yourself. This is the place where, you know, Mel Gibson's Braveheart took place in the lowlands of Scotland. You know, they're a warrior peoples, and they had a reputation for putting down, you know, the savage Irish in quotes, and later the savage, you know, North Americans. They were actually brought for that purpose by Elizabeth to Ulster. And then during our colonial period, a lot of landowners and proprietors actually brought them in as sort of border people to, you know, to skirmish with the indigenous people whose land was being taken and protect the wealthier seaside settlements. And so into the backcountry went this group who had, you know, an idea that you had to solve problems yourself. You couldn't trust the authorities and magistrates and armies to be there to defend you, right? You solve problems yourself. If somebody's wronged you, you go take care of it. You know, you settle it personally. Compare that with the Yankee tradition coming out of the early Puritans. Right. The Puritans were English people, but totally different group. They thought themselves to be like in a covenanted relationship with God, like the Old Testament Hebrews. They thought they'd been sent to the New England wilderness in an errand to, you know, put a light on a hill to make a more perfect society as they saw it. And they would be punished as a group or rewarded as a group. So they, you know, they watched out for each other. They deployed themselves as communities with, you know, a town meeting hall. And, you know, that was their joint church without any bishops or anyone above them, town meetings to organize their government. And you worked, if there was a problem, if someone had violated the rules or you had an altercation, you didn't settle it yourself. That was looked down upon. You had the magistrate settled who might use terrible violence to do so, but you don't take problems into your own hands. And that seems to be reflected in attitudes towards, you know, violence, insult, and how you react to it that scholars have shown for decades have shown that play through to today's indices of assault and especially argument-driven violence. And indeed, we see it, the same patterns matching up and backing up their assertions once we actually ran the regional map and traced those things.
Talking to Colin Woodard with the Nationhood Lab, looking at regional differences in gun deaths around the United States. He says longstanding cultural and historical traditions shape our attitudes toward guns in different parts of the country. A lot of variation from one part of the country to another, as we're hearing. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the differences in gun violence around the country? Have you lived in different communities, say urban and rural, or different states, maybe different countries? What cultural differences did you see when it came to firearms and attitudes toward firearms? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about gun deaths in the United States and how they vary from region to region. Colin Woodard is with us, author of the book American Nations. He says a lot of the differences go back to cultural patterns from the early European settlement of the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Colin, before we go to our callers, I want to zoom in on our our Yankee settled a neck of the woods here. One thing that struck me from what you wrote about was, while overall safer than many other regions when it comes to gun deaths, a big urban-rural distinction here in Wisconsin and our neighboring states, and a racial difference with other parts of the country. What do we see?
Yeah, the most surprising thing that was revealed was a racial difference in the patterns. There are enormous differences between the regions, and in general, the same regions are the bad regions, in quotes, and the other regions are the safe regions. They're reversed in many respects, though, when you look at just African-American victims in gun homicides. Suddenly, the relatively safe regions by almost all other metrics, including Yankeedom, where Wisconsin is, suddenly become among the most dangerous. And some of the most dangerous regions by all other metrics, the Deep South and Greater Appalachia, become among the safest. Now, it's not a 2, 3, 7, 9-fold difference, like the Deep South and Greater Appalachia, you know, 25, 30, 40% safer than the others, but still a very significant difference. And you wonder, why is that flip? I mean, this data refers specifically to urban counties, where about 55% of the national population lives, because the Centers for Disease Control, where this data comes from, starts suppressing data if we start slicing it too finely. So we weren't able to go into the rural for side-by-side comparisons the way we wished. But in cities, that is the pattern that you see. And the other intriguing thing is, it's only if you look down at a county level, where are the hot spots of those problems? There are a handful of cities. Milwaukee is among the more dangerous ones, Baltimore, Philly, Oakland, but not all of the cities. Like, inexplicably, as I mentioned before, New York City's incredibly safe. Boston's very safe. Minneapolis, when you're cutting it this way, Seattle. And you start wondering why the big difference between those places. And, you know, when you're looking at those kind of metrics. So I don't know the answers to why that is, but that is one of the intriguing things that, as academics like to say, shows new avenues of research to try to understand better.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Sun Prairie. Mike, hi.
I got two quick comments. One is that the TV networks, they've got no reason. They snort and holler about violence on the news and that sort of thing. But that's what all their programming is. You can't turn on any of these networks without having a shootout in front of you in about 15 or 20 minutes. And that's what gets some of these more marginal people fired up. And then they admire the weapons, too. And that comes to the other thing. I follow this website, and it's military officers. And I think most of them are fighter pilots. And they love to show pictures of their armament and all these Armalite rifles that no one needs, you know, unless you happen to be in a battle. I don't think any one of those guys has ever aimed a real gun at a real person, yet they think it's just the greatest thing. So,
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Colin, do you see in our pop culture, in our media, and in the way we, as Mike says, maybe glorify our firearms, differences in your American nations?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a big question, does art imitate life or life imitate art in there? That's not my area of expertise, but I will say that, yeah, there's a clear differences. I don't have data for it, but you see clear differences in how firearms fit in culturally. The sort of fetishizing sometimes of firearms isn't really done in New England, where I am. You know, I grew up in northern New England, northern Maine, where hunting was a fact of life. You know, everyone has shotguns and rifles and knows how to use them. They're tools. And, you know, people use them, and it's part, you know, my high school for, you know, when deer hunting season came around, half the kids weren't there because it was part of that tradition. But no one would go around with an AR-15 strapped to their back to the local Walmart as sort of some kind of symbol of being a free American. That would be considered some sort of sign that maybe you're not taking, you know, respecting firearms enough and are being a bit foolish. Whereas in other regions, it's very much a part of identity. You don't mess with me, and I'm, you know, asserting my Second Amendment rights and freedom in a way that just doesn't translate in other regions. And as I've asked experts anecdotally, for instance, in the far West, that's a region that encompasses about a fifth of the continental United States. It's the mountain states, but not the coast, not on the coastal side of the mountains, and the high plains, you know, everywhere in that sort of interior West that wasn't settled by New Spain. And in that region, they have very, very high per capita gun suicide rates, but quite low per capita homicide rates. And when I asked people why is that, there were a whole bunch of reasons about social isolation and stuff that explained suicide. But the best people could come up with was a similar explanation. We use guns as tools here. They're not seen as that sort of thing where you would resolve problems with them. It's like a hammer or a horse. And so there may be something to that, even though the evidence is still largely sort of anecdotal and observational. I do think there's something cultural at work in the sort of role and symbol that guns do or don't play in different regional cultures.
Thanks for that call. Joe joins us now in Platteville. Joe, hi.
Yeah, you kind of answered it with the things that you just said, but I was wondering what kind of your study found with dueling in the South, that honor and settling things with a gun would do with your study or what it showed.
Joe, thanks for the call. Colin, you do talk about that history of dueling culture.
Absolutely. I mean, that is consistent with all of the academic studies and literature people have done on that. That's another excellent example you raise, is especially in the Chesapeake country, you know, the Tidewater Zone, which were these, you know, second, third, fourth sons of the great English country families. You know, people like, you know, sort of like Lord Grantham on Downton Abbey, like his younger kids going to Virginia to start their own manor estates because they weren't going to inherit one. That was a culture in the 17th century and 18th century where dueling was how gentlemen settled disputes. You know, you wouldn't take it to the court. You would go because your honor had been insulted and you'd shoot at each other. And that spread all over the place. That's how Alexander Hamilton died. But you would never see dueling in New England or in the states that New England settled. That would be considered, you know, illegal and bizarre and perhaps somewhat savage in quotes, whereas it would be considered the most honorable and gentlemanly thing to do in the Tidewater region. So absolutely. Again, that plays to, you know, violence and the private use of violence, that you settle problems and slights on your honor yourself in some regions of the country, where in other regions that is entirely frowned upon and is exactly what you're not supposed to do.
Thanks for that call, Joe. Time for one more caller. Ryan is with us in central Wisconsin. Ryan, hi.
Hi, guys. Real simple stuff here. I inherited 78 guns from my dad. He passed away in 2018. And all it was a gun collection over time. And my grandpa in the 1800s come from Germany, and they brought their way of life here, and he owned a butcher. He was a butcher, and so on and so forth. And as growing up as a kid, like you said before, we had hunting camps here and conservation. So what we learned was conservation. It's very simple. And to process a deer and learn how to skin one and do that, that's very predominantly simple to do for guys like me. We go out there, and I do it the old-fashioned way. When I get one, I put it in the river. I clean it up with the water, or I take it down to my processing facility, and I got venison. It's nothing. It's very simple to do. And as far as dotting your I's and crossing your T's, we get it. It's all just about conservation.
I got you, Ryan. We don't have a lot of time left, but Colin, again, that attitude. This isn't, that was a collection, not an arsenal, I think. And a gun for Ryan was a tool for target shooting and deer hunting. I guess not a statement of a political attitude.
Yeah, or that you're collecting them because you expect to have to, you know, fend off the British or the federal government or something, that's your reason for collecting them is entirely different. And again, this is anecdotal, but that would be very consistent with the Northern New England experience and indeed the broader sort of Yankee cultural zone and all these attitudes that I described.
Thanks a lot for that call. And just our last minute, Colin, what is one of the biggest open questions for you on this map of gun violence in the United States?
I would love to know why it is that the homicide rate is so low in the far West, and to be able to zero down on exactly the stuff that we've been circling on here about the sort of cultural role of the firearms themselves. I mean, one expert in criminology I was asking, why is New Netherland, why is New York City so safe? And I expected them to say, well, it's because we have tight gun policies and stuff. What he actually said was, gun policies are all about essentially access to firearms, but culture is about what you do when you have the firearm or don't do. And I would love to see more research that is zeroing in on that, because I suspect there are very strong regional differences in the role of the weapons themselves as totems and pieces of identity that I think may get at the root of some of the differences we see in the actual death statistics.
Colin, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Colin Woodard, director of the Nationhood Lab at Salve Regina University's Pell Center. He's a Politico magazine contributing editor. His books include American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. Been talking about his work on regional differences in gun homicides and suicides in the United States. There's a lot more he gets into, and you can find a link to some of that info and some of the maps at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Republican member of the state legislature's Joint Finance Committee about the next state budget and top priorities for Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.